You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
This episode of See Here is brought to you by the Wilco Shriners Lounge. Come on down to the Shriners Lounge and see Willie Farr do his amazing chainsaw juggling routine. He juggles chainsaws, he juggles toasters, he juggles ex-wives. Next week, come back to see the amazing one-legged Wally Parr do his chainsaw routine. And you've heard it all on See Here.
Episode 40 of the See Here podcast. My name is Morris, and on the left of my Skype screen is Tim Merrill. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning.
And good morning, good evening, and good night to Mr. Bernard Stickwell.
Good night for me, yes.
There's a two Ronnie's line hanging in there somewhere.
There was.
And on the right of my screen is a masochist. And no, I'm not talking about the cinema masochist, although he is something of a cinema masochist, because this is his third time joining us on the See Here podcast, and we bow down to him at the Temple of Comedy. Mr. Frank Santopadre of the Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal podcast. Good afternoon to you, Frank.
Oh, it's about 5:15. Thank you for having me, gentlemen. Always a kick.
Thank you for being had. And today's film was built with you in mind, because basically today's film is Broadway Danny Rose, and you host a podcast which is really the podcast equivalent of this film, Broadway Danny Rose. A bunch of comedians talking around, swapping old Hollywood stories, and that's what we're going to do today. You seemed like the most apt guest that we could have.
I've had two people from the film on my podcast. Will Jordan and Joe Franklin.
Yep.
Indeed. I was trying to think for a second. Hang on. Danny Aiello wasn't in Broadway Danny Rose.
I think a certain individual's appendage has also made its presence known on the show.
Yes. Yes. He has a small role, ironically.
He was sleeping.
What we're going to do now is we're going to go to a quick break, play the trailer for the film, and then we're going to come back to actually discuss in some detail not only Broadway Danny Rose, but anything else Woody Allen related that we can think of. You're listening to See Here with myself, Tim, Bernie, and Frank. We'll be back in a moment.
Yes, and what did your husband do?
A little bookmaking, some loan sharking, extortion, like that.
Professional.
Who are you?
Danny Rose, theatrical management.
Who else do you handle besides Lou?
One of the great balloon folding acts of all time.
Do me a favor. I want you to bring Tina.
But she knows you're married.
That's why you gotta bring her.
You can't ride two horses with one behind.
Lou, she seems to be a little upset.
Some guys shot him in the eyes.
He's blind?
Dead.
He's dead, of course, because the bullets go right through.
Tina, I love you.
No, it's over.
Are you going with him?
She betrayed me with you. Danny Rose!
Get rid of the lover.
Lou, we're into a complete type of situation. Like the in the zone. He's a horrible, dishonest, immoral louse. And I say that with all due respect.
Often stranger than fiction, history is full of amazing stories. It is our collective experience that has left us where we are today. I'm Rob Sims, host of History in the Making. History in the Making drops you into the past using storytelling, thorough research, and a little bit of production to let you live history. Join me in ancient sea battles, foreign markets, and political fights to see why we are today. After all, we live history. History in the Making can be found on iTunes, Google Music, and Stitcher. You can also stream it for free anytime off my website, which is hitmpodcast.com.
Welcome back to episode 40 of the See Here podcast. Broadway Danny Rose is the film that we're discussing this time around. And I think just for a moment here, I want to try and justify how I came to pick. This month is my pick for the film. There are some of you out there who are thinking, well, this isn't really a music-related film. But I guess in the past, having discussed Alice's Restaurant and Ishtar and Suburbia and Mystery Train, I sort of felt that this was a justifiable pick. And certainly with Alice's Restaurant and Suburbia, they were films where music was a central part of the culture that was represented. And certainly in Broadway, Danny Rose, which is, you know, surrounding the Borscht Belt of Upper New York State. And, you know, Lou Canova, you know, being one of the central characters in this film. I guess I got to feeling that we're celebrating as much about the culture of cabaret, of stand-up comedy, and of that type of song. So I guess, you know, this show is as much about celebrating the culture as well as the music. From my perspective, that was a justifiable pick. Anyway, so I'm going to go around the table. Bernie, I picked this film because you'd gone and said that you'd watched it recently. You'd gone and watched the beautiful new Arrow release of the film. So I want to ask you, what was your first time that you can recall seeing a Woody Allen film?
I think it was Sleeper. Mm-hmm. I would have seen it around about 1979-80 on television over here in the UK, so I would have been about 9 or 10 years old. And certainly when I was younger, those earlier zanier films appealed to me more.
We enjoy your films, particularly the early funny ones.
If that kind of makes sense. Of course, by that point he'd only made a couple of the more adult movies, I guess. But yeah, I think Sleeper was the one for me.
It's kind of similar to Bernie's, as I remember ABC television used to have films on every Friday and Saturday night, and I remember seeing, I think it was Take the Money and Run.
Nice.
Mr. Miller.
I am pointing a gub.
No, that's gun. That's G-U-N. And that's gun. I am pointing a gun at you.
G-U-B.
No, it looks like a B, but it's an N.
And Bananas. And I remember seeing, when I was very young, seeing Everything You Wanted to Know About Sex, and all I remember was that just that giant floating boob chasing everyone. That was about it. But like Bernie said, you know, the zanier comedies. And what was the one about the French Revolution?
That was Love and Death.
Love and Death. I remember seeing that too.
If by some miracle I'm not killed tomorrow, would you marry me?
What do you think the odds are?
Frank, you're so ensconced in New York City, the home of Woody Allen. Was he always part of your life? What was the first thing you recall seeing?
That's a good question. You know, the first thing I remember seeing him in was not a Woody Allen movie.
Oh, yeah.
The first thing I remember seeing him in was the rather wretched Casino Royale.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
The first one, obviously, the comedy.
Sellers? Yeah,
Sellers. And I think that's the first time I saw him, and maybe the first or was aware of him. And the first Woody movie I remember seeing, I'm going to say it was Love and Death or Bananas. Mm-hmm. The first one I really made a lasting impression on me was Annie Hall.
God, Annie. Well, oh, well. La-di-da, la-di-da, la-la, yeah.
I was just going to ask, Frank, were you aware of his, you know, the fact that he'd written for a lot of, you know, sort of TV guys and so on prior to seeing his stuff, or did that come later?
He was a performer. I mean, I think I knew him as a television performer. Yeah, I mean, if you go back, if you do the research, I mean, he had TV specials.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
I think there's one where he's boxing there's some footage of him boxing a kangaroo, believe it or not.
You know, it's generally known to the public that I'm a guy who can handle his fists pretty good. Tonight on Hippodrome, you're going to watch me fight the Australian light heavyweight champion.
the things that he did back in those days. I mean, I remember him from early Carson shows. I was born in 61. So, Take the Money and Run is 69,
yeah.
If I have that right. So I certainly wasn't going to the movies and watching at the age of 8 or 9. So I remember him as being a television person.
I could be completely wrong, but I have a vague memory of Woody doing stand-up smoking on television. But I just remember him holding a cigarette or something, because I remember like a lot of guys would do stand-up where they'd be, you know, smoking.
Yeah. I can't remember.
I was going to say, if you remember the very early scene in Manhattan, you see him smoking around a table.
That is so great.
You don't smoke.
No, I don't smoke. I don't inhale because it gives you cancer. But I look so incredibly handsome with a cigarette that I can't not hold one.
Shit, I don't know. I remember him doing stand-up on shows like the Hollywood Palace, which was a kind of a precursor of Saturday Night Live almost, where they had a different host every week, variety show in the heyday of variety shows. And I remember him on Merv, and I remember him on Cavett. Mm-hmm. But I think the first thing that made an impression on me, I saw him in Casino Royale. I probably saw him in What's New Pussycat, right, too. But the first thing that I was 16 when I saw Annie Hall, and that's what had a real impact on me.
Right.
I think early on, I have two sisters, and one of them had a videotape of Take the Money and Run. So that is probably one of the earliest memories. And I think she might have also had Play It Again, Sam. So those are the earliest two things I recall seeing. And I have vivid memories of laughing myself silly watching Woody marching in the marching band playing the cello. And I just thought, you know, the ridiculousness of that. That made a big...
It's running ahead and setting up the stair.
Right.
Virgil steals to pay for cello lessons. And although he does not achieve greatness on the instrument, he is soon good enough to play in a local band.
My other sister was an English teacher in a high school, and she had been studying with her students The Crucible. So she made me come and watch with her The Front, which I sort of consider that was like this midpoint between the early comedic films. And I know this is directed by Martin Ritt.
Martin Ritt, who was blacklisted himself.
Right. Well, there was like, I think at the end of the film with the credits, it's listed like all the members of the cast and crew who were blacklisted back at the time.
Mm-hmm. I don't recognize the right of this committee to ask me these kind of questions. And furthermore, you can all go fuck yourselves.
But really, that film, it's so well written. It actually looks written, although no one would have picked it at the time because he'd only been making the zany comedic films. But if you compared it to what came afterwards, it played out like as if it was a Woody Allen script. And that is a film I've watched heaps and heaps and heaps of times. And so that was probably the first Woody Allen film I remember making a really strong impression on me. But probably the first two films, and I can't remember the order, but the first two films that I went to the cinema to see of Woody Allen was, you know, Broadway Danny Rose or The Purple Rose of Cairo, which I know came a year later, but I might have seen it at a repertory cinema or something like that. But so, yeah, today's film is certainly something that was fairly early on in my decision to watch everything that came afterwards. We are a music film podcast, and I know there's the Ajitar relationship, you know, with Nick Apollo Forte that we will get to, but let's talk for a few minutes just about the use of jazz in Woody Allen movies. And I know that the 80s were a time where you had your jukebox musical type films, you know, the soundtracks that were big either from television or from the movies, where there was a whole bunch of established songs and you could go sell your Cocktail or your Big Chills or your Tour of Duties or Goodfellas CDs. But in a way, I think Woody Allen, even though his albums weren't necessarily selling like those things, but in a way, he was a pioneer because he was championing, you know, music of the era that he loved. You know, your swing jazz, your pre-bebop jazz, and like every one of his films has a bunch of really fantastic jazz songs that he championed. A lot of those films become extra special. So, you know, the use of Sing 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 by Benny Goodman in like at least three films that I can recall. So, you know,
yeah, he loves to use that one.
The one film that I love, that one of my favorites of his, and I never gets enough recognition as far as I'm concerned, was Zelig.
Mm.
And Zelig, you actually get to see him play in it.
Absolutely. So long since I've seen that one.
Because, you know, when he's the chameleon and he's, you know, he's playing with the Dixieland band, and then, but there's music that runs through the whole film. It's fantastic.
Wasn't, if you want to see him play, I recommend the documentary too, Wild Man Blues.
Right.
Yep, I have seen that. Wasn't Woody Allen's band playing over the soundtrack of Sleeper?
I don't know. Was that his? Did he actually play on the soundtrack?
I'm 90% sure that it was his band that was playing the soundtrack of Sleeper. They weren't going to original recordings for that one.
Preservation Jazz Band?
I think so. I think that might have been his band.
Okay. I don't know. Mm. That's a good question.
You were mentioning before, Tim, about everything you wanted to know about Love and Sex. I love the opening credits, which was, I think that might have possibly been the last film that he did without the standard black background with white writing over the top, and you saw all those rabbits, and you got to hear Cole Porter's Let's Misbehave over the opening credits.
We're all alone, no chaperone can get our number. The world's in slumber, let's misbehave. There's something wild about you, child, that's so contagious. Let's be outrageous, let's misbehave. When Adam won his hand, he wouldn't stand for teasing.
I don't know. Was that maybe like the first film where he actually started using a jazz jukebox, if you will, and he's used it ever since, with, you know, a couple of exceptions, I guess. What was the first Scarlett Johansson film? Match Point, where he started using classical music.
Right.
Well, of course, then the Gershwin in Manhattan.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, but that was
Love
using
and Death as well was classical music, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah. I just looked on IMDb as well. He did play clarinet on the score of Sleeper, so one would assume that was actually his band playing.
Right.
There you
right.
go.
So, yeah. So,
nice call, Morris.
All right, well, look, let's just talk a bit about the 80s films that Woody Allen sort of started, because I know that whenever we sort of tend to read an article or think a lot about Woody Allen, obviously, you know, the big ones like Annie Hall and Manhattan come up as the first things that we think about. And, you know, they're brilliant films and obviously should be a lot in the conversation. But it seems to me that unlike some of the other iconic directors, I think Woody Allen was really on a roll through the 80s through to probably the mid-90s. I know that there are some people who sort of say, well, trying to think, you know, probably Crimes and Punishment might have been, you know, the last great film, and it was sporadic.
Oh, Crimes and Misdemeanors.
Crimes and Misdemeanors, excuse me, sorry, I'm thinking Dostoevsky. But I think the last, for me, Mighty Aphrodite was like as much of a belly laugh as anything that he'd done before. And that was like 96. Really, I think everything he did through the 80s into the 90s, it was a real purple patch. And Broadway Danny Rose is certainly a large part of that.
It's interesting you say that, Morris, because it's probably one of his not least known films, but least talked about and least appreciated. Certainly from that period, I would imagine.
I wonder whether that's the case now. I know for a long time it was sort of dismissed as light fluff, but I guess through the world of podcasting and more articles on the internet that I've seen, I think Broadway Danny Rose has come back into the conversation. It's still sort of being said, oh, it's not as good as Annie Hall and whatnot, but I think it has become a lot more appreciated in recent years.
I think it's one of Allen's favorites of his films. I remember reading that in several places.
I remember reading an interview with, I don't know if you guys know, a British comedian called Harry Hill.
Yeah. Sure.
But I read an interview with him a while ago talking about some of his favourite comedy films, and Broadway Danny Rose was his favourite. And he said the reason he liked it so much is that it's a comedian's movie. It's a comedy film for comedians, and it just, you know, makes perfect sense in that respect. So,
right. If you look at it, you know, from a certain perspective, the whole film is almost like this long joke, like a Shaggy Dog story.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
Do you think this qualifies as a screwball comedy?
Well, it has elements of that.
I sort of looked this up because there was this thing in my head. I thought, you know, male and female with some sexual tension, but is that enough to qualify it as a screwball comedy? And the definition that I read was that you have an emasculated man, a strong woman, going through a series of predicaments to make him look a bit of a doofus. And there's certainly, I guess, from the part of the film onwards where Woody comes to pick up the Mia Farrow character at her place and they go to the big mafia party, the road scenes where they're being chased by the brothers of the lovelorn guy.
Your brother is soft. He's sensitive.
Yeah, her husband had no respect for us either. Carmen Vitale, he was no damn good. He cheated us. And she's no better.
She said one thing to my face and she betrayed me.
It's the lover. He's got her under his spell, Johnny.
We'll fix him.
We'll chop his legs off.
No. We'll kill him. I don't trust him.
But not Tina. Please, not Tina.
Get rid of the lover. Get rid of the lover and you get her back. He's got the evil eye. C'hai il malocchio. You understand, figlio mio, il malocchio.
Mama, he's a dead man.
Johnny Rispoli, isn't it? And
Johnny.
It's Vito and Carmine Rispoli are his brothers, I think. Something
he's
like
a
that.
Poet.
Yeah.
Your brother is too soft.
He's sensitive.
Well, I think Danny when you White talk Roses. About screwball comedies, I think that a lot of Woody's earlier films, or a portion of his films, they always dealt with him being put in a different place that's kind of outside of his element. And that's always been the case, you know, where how Woody tries to fit into a new element, or how he tries to kind of convince everyone else he belongs there, or, you know, he knows what he's doing, but he's, you know, way out of his league, or he's just put in a situation that's kind of a compromising scene. That's where the humor comes through. And I mean, you know, it's like with this film where he's mistaken for this guy and for being the Lothario that's taking Mia away from Johnny. And, you know, and he's just saying, hey, I'm not the guy, I'm not the guy. But everybody's thinking he's the guy. And that's where all the humor comes out of it.
Right. It's just the beard.
Are you finished?
Yeah.
Because I have the greatest Danny Rose story.
The framing device of the film is a group of stand-up comics who I gather were friends of Woody's sitting in Carnegie Deli telling Danny Rose stories. So I got to ask you, Frank.
Including his manager is also in that scene, Jack Rollins,
yeah, right,
Woody's manager, who the character is reportedly based on, but I don't know how much truth there is in that.
Well, so was that a thing, Frank, for, you know,
comics to hang around the Carnegie Deli?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I think it was. I mean, those guys were all, they were all Borscht Belt comics. Sandy Baron and Jackie Gale. I don't know if you've ever seen Barry Levinson's Tin Men.
Oh, yeah. That's
Jackie
a great
Gale.
Film.
Yeah, Jackie Gale just about steals that one.
Right.
The late Sandy Baron, Howard Storm, of course, Will Jordan, who was the preeminent Ed Sullivan impersonator, and Corbett Monica also. Everybody's gone except for Will Jordan and Howard Storm. And Rollins himself, I believe, was a performer before he did. I'll double check on that, but before he became a theatrical manager. But I think that there's a tradition of comedians in diners and delis holding court. At a table. There's one up here on the Upper East Side where I live called the Green Kitchen, and it was near the old Catch a Rising Star. And if you go in that diner now, which is about three blocks from my home, you will see photographs, you'll see headshots on the wall of all of these comedians, not only from the 80s, but the 70s and the 60s, because they would perform at Catch and then walk to the only thing that was open, which was this little greasy spoon on the corner.
So that's been around for a long time, has it?
Yeah. There's a diner too here. There's the Comic Strip in New York is still open, and there's a diner on the next block. And you'll see, if you certain nights of the week, if you go in there, you'll see comics that are just performed mm-hmm. at the comic strip, because it's one of the few, if somebody's doing a late set on a weekend, yeah. the diner or the coffee shop is the only thing open.
Right.
The Carnegie closed, didn't it, a little while ago? Is it not around anymore?
Carnegie closed a couple of months ago, and it broke my heart, and the heart of a longtime New Yorkers.
Something I wanted to ask you guys about the comedian sitting down and sharing all the swapping stories in it. I got a little bit of a feel of almost like the Aristocrats from that. You know,
this would have been like a very different film.
No, I mean in the sense that it's like, oh, I got a Danny Rose story. No, I got a Danny Rose story. I got a Danny. You know, it's like everybody was riffing on their own take of Danny Rose, and I thought that was almost kind of like the Aristocrats, where it's almost like the same kind of, not exactly the same, but yeah. I just had a kind of feeling like that, you know?
I like as they're building up to telling the Danny Rose stories, they're just telling each other gags and doing impressions and stuff.
Right. Yeah, going to go home and change my suit.
Yeah, you kind of get the impression that Woody probably just said to them, yeah, just you know, do what you want to do for a little bit, and then we'll get to the kind of scripted part, you know, because mm-hmm. they're all kind of trying to get their little, you know, little piece of their acting.
Yeah, and so, if you Google those guys, Corbett Monaco was an Italian comic who was all of those guys played the Borscht Belt, played the circuit. Jackie Gale, Sandy Baron, Howard Storm, who's still around, actually, I should try to get him on my show. They're the perfect framing device to talk about a guy who is a theatrical manager who used to be a comic, who's a failed comic himself.
Right. Yeah, they're almost like a kind of Greek chorus, aren't they, narrating the story? Yeah,
a little bit. You know, the more you read about the film, he talks about Alan talks about it kind of growing almost improvisationally, like the whole thing. There's another famous restaurant in here in New York called Rao's, R-A-O. I don't know if you guys have heard of it.
No.
Legendary Italian eatery. And one of the owners was a lady named Annie Rao, who apparently spoke just like Tina.
Yeah.
And I've read interviews with Alan, with Woody, where he's saying that you know, it was a lark, that he wanted to play a different kind of character that he'd played before. Not a schlemiel, but a low-class character. And she wanted to play a character. She wanted to do something she'd never done before. And she was loosely basing her performance on this restaurateur, this woman, Annie Rao.
Wow.
Right.
So the movie has a lot of New York roots.
It's interesting that you say that Woody wanted to play something that was different. And while certainly, you know, he's still playing something of the schleb, and for, I don't know, whatever the umpteenth time in a film, he says, I want to interject something at this juncture.
Sweetheart, may I make one statement here? And I don't mean to be didactic nor facetious in any manner.
But his character in this film, I sort of felt, was a lot more altruistic. Like, normally he's very much of a narcissist and he's looking after his own ass. And Danny Rose, all he wants to do is look after his clients. I sort of remembered yesterday thinking about Annie Hall. Remember, there's that moment where I can't quite remember why it is, but there's this moment where he's sitting listening to some really lousy comedian tell a joke, and he's sitting there thinking, oh my God, this guy is terrible.
Jesus, this guy's pathetic. Look at him mincing around. Boy, thinks he's real cute. You want to throw up.
Got to get out of here. I can't wait to get out. And he keeps his smile plastered on his face, but he's hearing it. And yet, if the same comedian was there telling the same joke to Broadway Danny Rose would be saying, what you need to do is you need to smile, star strong. You know, I don't see you telling this joke in Joints. I see you telling this joke in Caesar's Palace. You know, he's far more encouraging of his clientele. And the beautiful scene at the end of the film, this guy would have been like a prince in his apartment. On the surface, he looks like the same sort of Woody Allen character that we get in so many of his other films. He's really, at his core, at his very nature, is a very different character this time around.
What's kind of funny is the lengths he goes to kind of satisfy, you know, his client. And he goes out, you know, and his client says, you know, I can't do my show unless I have this certain kind of gum. So Woody goes out and gets the gum, and unfortunately that gum gets stuck on his shoe. He wants to shake her, but he just can't shake her, you know. He's, no matter how much he tries, you know, she's stuck to him, and he's just like, oh shit, what do I do now, you know? Like,
it's probably his most likable character, you know, his most as Bernie said, he's the cockeyed optimist, his most optimistic character, sir, considering he's such a fatalist in so many of his other films.
Right. A lot of people talked about this film in a way as nostalgic, sort of paying tribute to Woody's comic roots. But I was sort of thinking that in a way this film is, maybe not quite anti-nostalgia, but it sort of works against the whole idea of being nostalgic for its own sake. I mean, there's all these lines in the film about, oh yeah, he's really riding the nostalgia boom. And yet, because Lou Canova is really seen as like a one-trick pony, as a one-song singer who had this song for 15 minutes, you know, many years ago, I sort of question whether it really is like doe-eyed nostalgia for its own sake. It's certainly not necessarily looking to the future, but it's let's tell these stories and then we'll get on with it. You know, even with Tina Vitale saying, you know, get what you want out of this life and just get on with it.
You know what my philosophy of life is?
Oh, I can imagine.
It's over quick, so have a good time. You see what you want, go for it. Don't pay any attention to anybody else. And do it to the other guy first, because if you don't, he'll do it to you.
She's the fatalist or the realist. Yeah. There's nothing nostalgic about it. It's like, get your 15 minutes. If you can make some money, go for it. You know, get a new agent, do what you're going to do for now.
Right.
And then Lou's nostalgic boom doesn't really turn out to be, we presume, what they thought it was going to be. So I think in a way it's, if not quite anti-nostalgia.
I think you can read it both ways, because Danny and his whole reason for doing what he does is because he's part of that. Mm. You know, he obviously grew up with, obviously reading a lot into this, but, you know, I think the film's kind of a tribute to the, you know, the kind of Borscht Belt and those kind of old comedians that Woody grew up with. And it's, you know, it's that kind of warmth and nostalgia coming from him. And the characters who don't have that so much kind of don't fare so well in the film.
Right.
And it's only through his kindness and his optimism and the fact that he is a nice, warm guy that he kind of offers the hand to her at the end almost with that scene you were talking about. So I don't know. I think you could read that both ways. I don't know. Maybe I'm reading too much into it. I don't know.
I don't see it as kind of a nostalgia per se, as I see it as that. You know, there was a time when everything was the same and everything could kind of be, was malleable and everything could kind of be controlled. And then when things change, you know, you have to deal with change and you have to deal with evolution or just the, accepting the fact that there's things you can't control. When Woody comes up at the beginning and he's talking to the guy about, you know, hey, man, why don't you book birds? Why don't you book this? Why don't you book that? And he's like, we don't do that anymore. We don't, you know, it's like things change, you know, and he has to learn how to not rely on the past or not just rely on, you know, the things that, you know, he could control or the things he could manage, because, you know, life sometimes is not manageable.
You can be informed by the past and still manage to go forward, which is what I think, that's kind of where the ending leaves it, I think.
Right.
And yet, like, his character all throughout the film, we get just like a glimpse, just enough of Danny as a stand-up comic from, you know, an earlier period. You know, he's doing the joke, how old are you, sweetheart? What's your star sign?
Let me ask you a question, sweetheart. How old are you? Just tell me how old you are.
81
years old. Isn't that fantastic? No, really. She's 81. Fantastic. Unbelievable. You don't look a day over 80.
And all throughout the film, to get himself out of an awkward situation or to start up a conversation, how old are you, darling? What's your star sign? It's like he's never stopped being that stand-up comic.
Yeah, he never stops performing, does he?
And the further he goes on in the film, we realize this is not working. You know, he's at the party where he's trying to get Tina, and when he's in this awkward situation where her scorned lover, I think he's already taken the poison, Danny Rose calls up to his mother, don't worry, what star sign are you? How old are you, darling? And that's sort of where I get the anti-nostalgia sort of feel from, because it's showing, no, that doesn't work anymore, Danny.
Well, that's kind of like what I was saying about, you know, trying, you know, he lived in an environment where he tried to control everything, you know, or he could manage it. And then when things are out of hand, he's just like, no, man, you know, you're on your own. You're flying by the seat of your pants now. You got to figure this out.
Can I just go off on a little tangent here? You're talking about the party that Woody's character, Danny, follows Mia's character too. That scene, that whole scene at the party is indicative of something that this film does really, really well, in that I think the extras casting and the way that the film is shot, just loads and loads of really interesting faces, lots of close-ups of faces, real-looking people, strange-looking people.
It's Fellini-esque.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. And it's just, it's a beautiful film as well. It's beautifully shot. It looks fantastic.
Gordon Willis.
Yeah, he did a bang-up job. There's the scene where they've just gotten off the boat after crossing the Hudson, and they're just kind of walking along and talking, and the camera tracks along. and you've just got this old pier and fog sort of enveloping them. And it's just absolutely gorgeous, beautiful to look at.
I'm reminded of the two guys who are tearing up the money.
I've been tearing money since my first Holy Communion.
$10.
I don't care. Here. Yes, absolutely. Mere fascination.
It's a mere fascination.
All the conversations he has at that party with the he's talking with that guy about the comic he saw in Atlantic City.
Yeah, who the put dirty his thing comic.
In, yeah, and he says, "Well, if it's old fashioned to like Mr. Milton Berle or Mr. Danny Kaye,
you know, they call me old fashioned. But if it's old fashioned to like Mr. Danny Kaye, Mr. Bob Hope, Mr. Milton Berle, you know what I mean? Then all right, then I'm old fashioned. Right. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah."
And the smile on that other guy's face is just perfect, so good.
He's an idealist, you know. His character is an innocent surrounded by cynicism and surrounded by harsh reality.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, there's the one scene when Tina goes to his house and she says, "Hey, man, like, look at this place. Like, you're like a loser." And he's like, "No, you know." He says, "I could become famous overnight. You know, like I could change. You know, like everything's going to change instantly. Don't worry about it. You know."
He's a dreamer.
Yeah.
You know, it's that's one of the things that's so sweet about the film, too, because there are so many people like that in show business. Lifetime believers against all odds. And that's one of the things that's so damn endearing about him.
Mm-hmm. But I think for some people, that's how things happen, is when, you know, people will refuse to give up a dream. You know, sometimes people are saying, "This will never be made. This will never happen. You know, there's no place for you." Look at a guy like Charles Bronson with a, you know, like a chiseled catfish face. And look, you know, look what he was able to do and make a career out of. Initially, you see that guy and you think, there's no way you'd be a leading man in a film or something. But no, I mean, you know, you follow the dream.
One day you will hold my caramilla. A child of your own, and I pray.
Could I bring up at this point Nick Apollo Forte? Because I did a bit of research. Apparently so, yeah. I did some research, checked his own website and so on, and there's not a huge amount of information about him out there. I think he was essentially just playing himself, and this is pretty much what he does, yeah.
There was a record store here in Times Square, speaking of New York landmarks that are gone, like the Carnegie, called Colony Records.
Oh.
And it was adjacent to the world-famous Brill Building. And Julia Taylor, was Woody's longtime casting agent, was in Colony Records and happened upon one of Nick Apollo Forte's albums. And that's reportedly how he was cast.
Oh. Apparently, they saw a bunch of other people for that role, and it's actually quite amazing who was up for it. Apparently, if I have this right, Sylvester Stallone tried out for it. Robert De Niro.
Yeah.
I think Robert Goulet and Steve Roth.
If Stallone had done it, it would have been like that. What was that movie he did, that comedy?
I was going to say Paradise Alley is the one where he sings the theme tune, isn't it?
You mean Rhinestone with Dolly Parton?
No, that's the one. The gangster film that he did.
Oh,
the Oscar. Yeah,
he didn't sing an Oscar, though, did he?
No, but it would have been something like Oscar.
He knew enough to cast an unknown in that part. You needed one.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, disbelief that you weren't looking at Mia Farrow under this and Woody Allen was enough, you know, without having to look at Sly Stallone and believe him as a lounge singer.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Can you imagine that?
And the interesting thing is that Nick Apollo Forte's career since then, I think he's done like one television appearance or maybe one other movie, but I read somewhere that he was actually offered like a small role, probably as a nightclub singer in The Sopranos, and he turned it down. So
because he didn't want to use the language. He didn't like the profane language, apparently.
Right. That's the story. He has 22 grandkids, I read.
Wow. Speaking of language, seeing him up there singing, I was watching the film thinking, he looks like somebody. He looks like somebody. And then finally it hit me. He looks like Tony Clifton.
How you doing? All right. Nice to see everybody out here. Everybody feeling good?
That's funny.
And I thought, yeah, man, like, you know, a little bit. It's the mustache. That's what it was.
Considering he's not, he wasn't an actor or anything. He was, you know, a performer, obviously, but not an actor. He knocks it out of the park in this. He's absolutely fantastic. He just nails it, I think.
Well, I think there's some directors that know how to cast or how to guide, you know, non-actors through films. Yeah. And many cases, like, that's what you need, is you need the people that are just naturally themselves, that they're not trying to be anybody else. And I've seen several films where it's just worked so well, you know, because, you know, the people just play it perfectly, pitch perfect.
Well, like you say, it's the right casting, isn't it? It's the right person. Yeah, yeah.
I think it turned out to be a natural actor, too. I think that was the pleasant surprise.
Yeah.
They said he gave a great read. So after they'd seen all these famous names, this guy was the real deal. So that must have appealed to him on some level. This guy's actually it. He's the bad lounge singer.
Right.
Why hire Danny Aiello or Robert De Niro to play one?
Right.
So Ajita actually already existed as a song even before the film. They just brought that into the film, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Apparently he wrote something called the Skunjili song, which I love.
So what's that about? So,
I don't know. I'm going to assume it's about octopus or squid. I guess squid is Skunjili is squid.
Yeah. There's a question I wanted to ask about the music, and this is my naivety, but to me, there's always been kind of this similarity between a lot of Jewish klezmer music and Italian, traditional Italian. I mean, like a lot of the songs to me seem like one and the same. And I think Woody blends that in the film because it doesn't seem like they're two different things. It seems like everything just runs right through.
It's a perfect fit.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, that thought hadn't occurred to me. That's actually a really fantastic observation. But what we notice, so like not so much in the chorus of Ajita, but in the verse of Ajita, it's in a minor key. And a lot of klezmer music, I've often sort of noticed it has that wonderful ability to take tunes that are in a minor key and still sound incredibly joyous. And that's what Ajita does in this film. So yeah, that's actually a really, really good observation.
Well, a lot of the rhythms, I mean, when you hear it, it's just like that, you know, like it's just, I'm like going, wait a minute, man. Like this is almost one in the same, you know, it's just, but I love it. I love all of it. I mean, it's fantastic.
And give Dick Hyman credit, too, because he takes those two songs, My Bambina and Ajita, and they come back, variations on those songs.
Yes, yeah.
Are threaded throughout the film, very expertly.
Credit out there to the accordion player, a guy called Dominic Cortez. If, Frank, I know you're a Billy Joel fan, he was the squeeze box player on Scenes from an Italian Restaurant.
I'm familiar with him.
Right. Is he still around? Does he still?
I don't know. That's a good question. I'll look it up after we sign off. But the music is fun. I mean, the music keeps things moving.
Right.
It certainly does. Actually, I mean, we often sort of go and wonder, you know, how much effect the music plays on a film. And I know that it's been like an internet phenomenon in recent years to recast trailers. So I think, you know, Mary Poppins as a horror movie and Taxi Driver as a romantic comedy. And it's all usually due to the music. There are moments in this film where, you know, there would have been less comedic without the use of Ajita in the background.
It's a lot of traditional Italian music, too. I'm thinking of the traditional song Finiculi Finicula.
When I was in public school, we actually had to learn to sing that song.
Yeah. I think it's used in the closing credits.
It is. It's right at the very end, yes. Yeah.
Right.
All I know is he's a big talent and he's playing joints.
Joints? What do you mean? He was lucky he could get you. When I met him, he was still singing Finiculi Finicula.
You know, again, the character supposedly, and I've been doing research on this, they say that Jack Rollins, Woody's manager, was an inspiration because he managed Harry Belafonte.
That's it, and yes,
Harry,
yeah.
Harry Belafonte reportedly, and you know, you can piece this together if you want, reportedly left him for a more successful manager, and that was some of the basis of this story, and I don't know. And I remember years ago hearing the name of another manager. I spent about a half an hour before I jumped on with you guys researching it, and for the life of me, I couldn't find it. Somebody named Dave something. Huh. And if you guys can find it, or if any of your listeners can dig it out, I'll be very, very impressed. That Danny Rose was a composite of several different people.
Right.
And one of these guys was a failed theatrical manager named Dave somebody. And I can't find his name on the internet for the life of me. So I'm going to have to ask some people who would know. I'll ask Will Jordan. Well, I think Jack Rollins there turns up, by the way, too. I think Jack Rollins' mother is one of the balloon folders.
Oh, nice.
If you take my advice, I think you're going to become one of the great balloon folding acts of all time, really. Because I don't see you just folding these balloons in joints. You know, you're going to, you listen to me, you're going to fold these balloons at universities and colleges.
That's it.
You sure, actually, Frank, you sure she's not the hypnotized lady?
I don't know. I have to go to IMDb.
The balloon folders were a married couple, weren't they, I think?
Relying on my memory.
Speaking of unfolding balloons, we have to bring up Uncle Milty.
Nicely done.
We're not a family podcast to the last time That's I checked. So, Frank, do you want to sort of tell our listenership, who may not have had the good taste to listen to Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal
Podcast? You mean they don't know? This is not common knowledge by this point?
About the baby's arm? No.
It wasn't until I listened to your podcast.
Baby's arm holding an apple.
If you don't know this, shame on you, because it's showbiz history lore 101. But Uncle Milty was famous for having the largest endowment in show business, and he
wasn't an endowment of the arts.
Not an endowment of the arts. although the Chubb Group may have underwritten. That's a PBS joke that would play
in
America.
I think it was the inspiration for Dumbo.
I hope you guys got it. Yeah, we've had several people on the podcast who've told us that Milty actually showed it to them. One was Saturday Night Live writer Alan Zweibel claims to have seen it in person. At least one other person. We have Tony Roberts on the podcast Monday, speaking of Woody Allen, by the way.
Right.
Oh, wait.
When he worked with Milty, Milty dated his mom.
Oh, Uncle my Milty, goodness.
Tony Roberts' mom. So, but he never saw it. We asked him.
You know what's really funny is actually,
as we ask everybody,
we referenced it a little bit earlier when they were saying about, the dirty comedy. And he says, and some guy comes out with a cigar box with a hole in it and sticks his stink through it. And I was thinking, Milton.
It's humor. You know what's interesting about Milton in the film is he doesn't speak.
Both of his
scenes are MOS scenes. You see him on the float and drag.
Yep.
And then you see him in Times Square and there's a voiceover.
Right.
And you see him. He's in the Waldorf as well, isn't he? And he's sat next to Howard Cosell for some reason.
That's right.
Sandy Baron doing the voiceover of how, Uncle Milty needs an act for his nostalgia. Yeah, yeah. But it's great to see him in there. Just his presence, even though he doesn't speak, just his presence gives this film, which is about old-time comedy, it gives it something. It gives it a little extra gravitas.
Absolutely.
And the other guy that really came up to my mind when I was watching this film was your friend Drew Friedman. I saw so many shots in the film that would look almost like Drew's illustrations, like with the guy sitting around the deli, and there was just certain faces, like Bernie had said, too, that just pop up, and I just thought, that looks like a Drew Friedman drawing. Like, this person...
Drew has those books, the old Jewish comedians book.
Right. Yeah.
Somebody nicknamed Drew, I think it was, I'm trying to think, it was Newsweek or Vanity Fair, they called him the Vermeer of the Borscht Belt.
That's it, yeah. Which, apparently there's a documentary in production, isn't there?
And there is.
The name
there
of
is.
It, yeah. Yeah.
Being made by our friend Kevin Doherty, friend of the podcast.
Oh, okay.
So that is in development. So, yeah, you look at Broadway Danny Rose and you think of that. You can smell the corned beef coming off the screen.
Wow. Oh, absolutely.
They say that about Drew's drawings.
Right. Mm-hmm.
What we need is a graphic novel adaptation of Broadway Danny Rose. Drew Friedman. That would be astounding, wouldn't it?
I'd kill to do that, to write that.
That'd be perfect. You and Drew, do it.
Well, we collaborate on smaller things, but never a book.
So do you think a film like this could have been made nowadays? Were the 1980s just distance enough from that whole Borscht Belt era that enough people remembered it?
A good question. I don't know. I think if it was,
it would be probably out in Vegas, either Vegas or Los Angeles. And they would totally, take it away from New York. And now it would be your agent on a cell phone. And, it would just totally wouldn't be the same.
Right. You're so right. His films were always made for niche audiences anyway, though.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, on one hand, you want to say, well, it was 84, so you weren't that far removed from the Borscht Belt. Incidentally, there's a new book by a photographer named Marissa Scheinfeld. I'm giving a plug to someone I don't know because the book is terrific. It's called The Borscht Belt, Revisiting the Remains of America's Jewish Vacation Land. And what she did is she went to all the old hotels. She went to Grossinger's and some of the names of them are jumping out of my head. And basically, she took photographs of what was left. And it's just heartbreaking to see what's left of these. See if you guys can pick up the book because... So, it's a heartbreaking history.
Has she gone and sort of documented that a lot of these hotels no longer exist, or that they just don't put up entertainment anymore?
She went and photographed what was still standing.
Wow.
You know, empty rooms and buildings in disrepair and empty swimming pools.
Hmm. Just history left to rot. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's sad, but it's part of this history. I think it's it relates to this topic.
So what did the book imply about what started the decline of the Borscht Belt?
I don't know. I think television had something to do with it.
I'd maybe assume that it's a generational thing as well. Older
people
who were that was where they went for their holidays and entertainment. You know, their children were doing other things and going other places, and it was maybe seen as old fashioned. And old hat. I don't know.
Yeah. Sure. We may have her on the show for a mini episode that we do, so perhaps she'll explain it. But if you get your hands on the book, I mean, it's like you're looking at pictures of Chernobyl.
Right.
I mean, it's these places, ghost towns. The fact that some of the structures are still standing, and you see the old bowling alley, or the old auditorium, or the old swimming pool, where these tumblers, people like Mel Brooks back in the day worked. Mm-hmm.
So were they literally kind of out in the middle of nowhere? It was literally just a hotel resort.
Yeah, the Poconos and upstate New York, what's left of them. I mean, the ones that haven't been raised.
Wow.
You know,
it's the same way I see old theaters and drive-ins, what's left of them. It just breaks my heart. I can't even look at that stuff anymore. It just brings tears to my eyes.
I said movie theaters are on the endangered list now. The Ziegfeld Theater here in New York, which was an institution, closed.
Right.
It's going away. I'm not sure if Weinstein's Majestic Bungalow Colony is still standing, by the way. From the movie. But I hear it's a classy place.
Majestic Bungalow Colony. Is that a euphemism again for Milton Berle?
No, it's when he's trying to book Lou, and the guy says, he's a washed-up has-been singer.
That's right.
Then he's trying to sell him on the blind. Is it the blind xylophone player? And he says,
Mike,
they don't want to see a blind act.
Right. I always thought that Letterman riffed on all that stuff with his stupid pet tricks and his stupid people tricks.
A little bit. Another guy managed by Jack Rollins, by the way. So maybe there was a connection. And then he says, Weinstein's Majestic Bungalow Colony is a classy place, which is one of my favorite lines in the movie.
I'd like to help you, Danny. But Weinstein's Majestic Bungalow Colony is a classy place, and I need a classy act.
Yeah, a lot of great little New York character actors showing up, too. It's a period film about New York at that time, even though he's trying to make a film. He says he set out to make a film about New York in the 1950s, and it's very strange because the film is timeless.
Right.
And he's walking past at one point a movie marquee, and you see a Halloween movie.
Right,
that's
right,
Halloween
right.
3, yes, yeah, yes, yeah.
And it's clearly not the 1950s, and if you look at Burl, who's clearly in his 70s or late 60s, it's clearly not the 1950s. So it's one of those strange films that has no time period.
And then there's part of it too that reminds me not of New York City, but it reminded me of New Orleans when they were in that giant warehouse with all the parade stuff.
Yeah.
That scene struck me as Frank said earlier, that's a little kind of Fellini-esque, isn't it? It's a little surreal and kind of out of place with the rest of the film, but works because of that in a way.
Sure.
Well, he needed something, right? I mean, he's sitting there and he's plotting the screenplay, and he's coming up on the third act, and he needs a big piece of business.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the kind of adventure, isn't it?
He needs to make the adventure bigger and grander somehow. So that's what he came up with.
In that regard, it's part road movie then.
A little bit.
Yeah. Kind of.
And given that the road movie is always like a metaphor, a character's journey. Really,
well, that makes sense as well.
This is more about Mia Farrow's personal journey, and she goes from being, you got to live for yourself, you got to do things for yourself, I say grab it, until her final feelings of guilt at the end of the film, and Danny sort of forgives her, which is not really a very Woody Allen thing from previous films. That adventure that you mentioned is part of that road movie.
I guess you could call it a road movie, and you could call it a screwball comedy, and you could call it a character study, piece.
Very much.
I think it's all those things, and a love story too.
Yeah, yeah.
He doesn't stay with it long enough for you to actually see them get together, but it's implied.
Mm. Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
Which is brilliant filmmaking unto itself.
Yeah, I mean, a kiss would have served him. I mean, you it's hard enough to wrap your mind around these two characters actually falling for one another. But the fact that he holds on that last shot and leaves it to your imagination is so well done.
At that point, it doesn't even matter whether what happens after the film is whether they have a romantic relationship or not. It's, you know, at that point, there's been forgiveness and that they've got a friendship. Yeah. It, the romance would almost, in a way, sort of think would be an easy way out, would be a disappointment. Just the fact that, you know, she's accepted what she's done is wrong. He's forgiven her. And it just works really nicely.
You're right. I don't think we can assume that it even blossoms into a romance.
There's something really unique about, like, you know, just in the last couple of minutes about what you've been saying about all these elements coming together. And if you had asked someone else, another director, to kind of make a film similar to this and put all those elements together, I don't think they could even come close. I mean, I think the way Woody weaves it all together is very unique unto himself. I don't think that it's the way he does it seamlessly. I don't think that it's really something that can be duplicated.
It doesn't feel forced at all, does it? It all works perfectly.
And speaking of that run through the streets, I want to direct you guys to, after we get off, check out a website called Vanishing New York. And then when you get to the website, punch in Broadway Danny Rose, because what someone has done is taken the time and trouble to match scenes from frames from the film with what those New York streets look like today.
Wow.
So you can see where the Oyster Bar that was on the corner that's near the same block as the Carnegie, and that's still there, but all the stores in the middle of the block have changed. It's a fun website that does that with several movies, like The Apartment. I think Annie Hall.
I've seen something like that with, do you know the photographer Frank Ouija?
Of course.
Yeah, well, Ouija is somebody's, there was a website, I forget who did it now, but where they actually split the screen and half the screen was the Ouija photo and the other half, the right side of the screen was present day.
Oh, interesting.
So they actually showed where there was a building on fire and people were jumping out of the building, or where there was like a gangland shooting that Ouija had shot and this was the alley and like all that stuff. It was really fascinating like that.
Well, this site does a lot of that. They it's devoted to the New York of old, but also they will take films. I think Annie Hall is another one. There's several Woody Allen films where they've actually matched. They'll show you there's a scene where, I'm trying to think, in Annie Hall where they're having the argument about the professor that she's sleeping with, and they're walking through the streets and he matches buildings. So he goes to the site, he goes to the location, he or she, you know, and they photograph what it looks like today and they actually match it. You can see where construction ended or where something else was built or where the park bench was still there or has been removed. It's really very interesting.
Right.
He does that with Broadway Danny Rose.
Huh.
Or they do that. I don't know who it is who's behind it, but
we'll put the link in the Facebook group because that sounds really interesting.
Absolutely.
It is. It's engrossing.
Okay, I promise you, if your wife never wakes up again, I promise you I will take you to any restaurant of your choice.
Not to go off on a tangent, but sometimes you and Gilbert like to talk about those really cheapo horror films, those Italian horror films. Well, a lot of those were shot in New York. And there used to be Italian post-apocalyptic films like Bronx Warriors and a lot of those old films.
Oh, yeah.
We're all shot, you know, basically what was left of Manhattan. I mean, like, it was just, you know, the Bronx. And it looked like
wasteland.
Like Lebanon. Yeah, yeah.
And I used to see them in movie theaters that are also gone.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, sure.
So we're going to do a mini episode in the next couple of weeks about movie theaters that have disappeared.
Nice. All those cinemas that turned into kind of smut cinemas and a lot of the grindhouses, they actually started as theaters of the performing arts. Old vaudeville places. I mean, in Toronto, we used to have a place called the Metro that was like the last adult cinema in Toronto. And initially it started back, I think, in like 1929 or something, you know, as the only place you could see dancing girls and guys going up and doing comedy routines. And that was like going right all the way back, like I said, to the 20s and 30s, right? So
and the town I grew up in Long Island was called Mineola. Well, it still is. And it was the Mineola Movie Theater. And I found out doing a little research that Henry Fonda appeared there in a production of 12 Angry Men.
Oh, wow.
So it was a legit theater before what they call an equity theater before it became a movie theater. And that was true. That's true here of a lot of the theaters in New York, particularly the ones in Times Square.
Right.
But many of those are gone. New York are always vanishing.
So this is a real postcard, this film, you know, it's a real snapshot of an era that's, you know, unfortunately no longer around. We're lucky enough to be able to see it.
I think that's going to be true of all of Woody's films years from now, because they're all shot in New York. So most of the major ones in the 80s, to a point. When you go back, I was watching Serpico to do research. We had Tony Roberts on the show. And I'm looking at these things. I'm looking at cigarette machines on a subway platform and candy machines, which you also see in the taking of Pelham 123. And you Well, Gilbert and I love to talk about movies shot in New York in the 60s and 70s and how much of the city becomes a character.
Some people don't believe me when I'm telling them this, but I remember, you know, in New York City, like in seeing it even in films, they used to have billboards for cigarettes where you would see the smoke billowing out of a cigarette.
Times Square was famous.
Yeah.
So it's not a sleazy place anymore?
Well, it had its, you know, it wasn't always safe, but it also had its charms.
Right.
Since I moved back to New York in 2003, so much was clear. There was a great old coffee shop called the Empire Diner, which was one of these Carnegie Deli type places where you could go in and you could see Jackie Mason at a table holding court. And you could see these old-time character actors sitting around like a real greasy spoon, but one with real history. And that's gone, and the Ziegfeld closed, and Carnegie closed, and so many landmarks. But it's happening in L.A. too. I'm sure it's happening where you guys are.
Starbucks makes great coffee, right, Frank?
I belong to another era, gents.
Me too.
I think we all do.
My friend Jim said something profound as I was lamenting the Roseland went away, which was an old dance hall near the Ziegfeld. That's gone too. And I was
Roseland. I actually saw a show at the Roseland. They used to put on rock concerts there.
Yes, indeed, and roller skating. But it was a dance. It was a ballroom and a dance hall in its heyday. And my friend Jim Farrow said, you know, he said 150 years ago, someone was standing where you're standing right now, lamenting what they tore down to build, the loss of what they tore down to build back. And I suppose that's true.
Yeah.
You know, that you know, everything is of its time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that doesn't make you feel any better, does it?
Doesn't make me feel any better, no. You know, diners are disappearing from New York. Places like the Carnegie Deli, diners, coffee shops are vanishing in New York. Like I said, since I came back 10 years ago, 12 years ago, I think 4 movie theaters have closed in my neighborhood alone.
Jeez.
So, it's that's another show.
I like the looks of you, the Lord of you.
All right, well, speaking of another show, we're going to finish off this one. So just final thoughts around the table, gents. A favorite moment for the film, a favorite memory associated with the film. We'll start with you, Frank.
Oh, God, there are so many. I mean, I did the absurdity of meeting that actor in the superhero costume, you know, Ray Webb, the actor. I love when Sandy Baron is talking about Danny, how he's a landlocked Hebrew, traveled by water, and they're on the ferry.
Yeah, yeah.
He says, and it may have been improvised, he says, what color is his face? It's khaki. Yeah. The man has a khaki face. And I also love when he says, when he's trying to talk his way out of the beating by the two brothers, and he's talking about his unattractive aunt.
But, you know, take my cousin Seal. Not pretty like Tina at all. She looked like something in a reptile house at a zoo.
Who says, she looked like something you pick up in a live bait store. There are so many. Where do you begin?
That's the other running theme. What we were discussing before about how Danny Rose never quite gave up the act all throughout the film, as well as sort of asking people what their age or star sign was. He would always, in the course of regular conversation, like you said, take my Aunt Rose, or I'd like to tell you about Rabbi Pearlstein, or he's always talking about someone a little bit like Gabe Cotter. I want to tell you about my Uncle Moishe, or I want to tell you about...
it shows you the brilliance of the character. Because this is all he knows. All he knows is being this guy and being an entertainer, and he thinks that he can use it to get by in any social situation.
Right.
Even when his life is threatened, he's going to tell him about his Uncle Menachem. It's just so wonderful.
What I was saying about, you know, about him being – in kind of a ability to control everything all the time. And then when he gets into situations where it's out of his control, he still tries to rein it in. You know, he's still trying to get a leash on it. And it's like, no. Like,
it's tough. As Frank said, there's so much in this. It's just full of gold, this film. So many little jokes and one-liners. And I love, as we were just talking about, how he's got a story for every situation to, you know, tell anybody. And I think my favorite line is, I'm paraphrasing here, I don't remember it entirely, but he says, my Uncle Morris, the famous diabetic from Brooklyn.
The famous diabetic.
And it's just his throwaway. He's on to the next thing. What sums this film up? Because to me, it's, again, he's talking about another relative of this, of his, who whose philosophy for life is acceptance, forgiveness, and love.
Yes.
And I think that sums up the film. That is what the film is about. And perfect. You know, you can sum it up better than that, I think. So, and I will say it's wonderful. It's probably in my top three Woody Allen films.
Nice.
I could watch this one over and over and over.
Me too.
I wouldn't say there's a favorite scene for me, but the one aspect that I really love about this film is that him as a manager, he's basically trying to push all of his clients, saying, well, he's this, when they're really not. But then when something is put on him and they're saying, you're this, he's like, no, I'm really not, you know, like, you're the guy, you know, you're the Lothario, you're the guy stealing the girl, Tina. And it's like, no, that's not me. Like, you know, everybody's seeing qualities in him and he's trying to deny it through the whole film. It's kind of funny. It's ironic how he's trying to, you know, bring out the other qualities in all the people he manages and kind of overextenuate that. But at the same time, he's just kind of really, you know, denying all these things in himself.
One of the things that I sort of come away with is actually one of the sadder moments where he comes to his own sort of realization about something that he's done wrong. I've already gone and said that his character is something of an altruist. But to save his skin, at one point, he goes and gives the name of the character Barney Dunn.
Come on, tell us, who you bidding for, you little cheese eater? I don't know exactly what it means, but I know it's not good.
Who are you bearding for? I'll put a bullet right between her eyes.
Wait a minute. Don't do that. Talk.
Daddy, don't. They'll kill him.
I don't want to get my legs chopped off because I do a guy a favor.
Come on, let's go. Who is it?
All right. You want to know who it is? Should I tell you who it is? Should I say? It's Barney Dunn.
Who's Barney Dunn? Come on, who is it?
Daddy, you wreck.
Get it.
And so he tries to save his skin by giving the mafia guys the name of this other comedian who he says, oh, yeah, he's the real Lothario. He's the real guy. And they end up putting him in hospital. And Danny's the one guy who goes to visit him in hospital. And he's, you know, bandaged up to the hilt. And he just walks away in the rain and is absolutely feeling traumatized that he's done.
It's heartbreaking.
It is a heartbreaking moment. You know, Lou Canova has gone and walked out on him, but he feels worse because he's done the wrong thing by this character. And this is a real film of humor and pathos. Bernie, when you said that this film is in your top three, I can't argue with that. I don't know if it is my number one, but yeah, certainly in my top three. I adore this film so much. It really is a five-star movie for me. And I can't remember the last time he did a five-star. I mean, I can't give up on him because every once in a while he comes up with a film and think, oh, wow, you do have still something in you. And very rarely, though, is it the one that's the common perception. I remember, you know, however many years ago, people went gaga over Match Point. And I've got to say, I hate Match Point. The first 30 minutes sort of play out like a weak Woody Allen film, and then the rest of it is not a Woody Allen film at all. That's a little bit
French Misdemeanors Revisited.
Yeah, I guess, but that still looks like a Woody Allen film. But the last part of Match Point, nah, not at all.
Not as good. I had such a bad experience after Scoop, and what was the other one? The one with Jason Biggs. Anything else?
That didn't get released here. That didn't even get released here.
And I just thought, wow. At some point, it was just too painful to go back to the theater and watch him flail.
Yeah.
And I know Midnight in Paris was a comeback, and so I enjoyed that.
Did you guys see Blue Jasmine? What do you think of that?
Hated it.
I did like Blue Jasmine, but I thought, again, you know, a minor.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
A minor note. I think that, you know, he doesn't really have his fastball anymore. I mean, what artist stays that vital and that sharp, you know, into his 80s?
Right.
Looking wilder then, you know, but he had a hell of a run.
Certainly did, and for far longer than what a lot of people give him credit for. I mean, I think you've kind of mentioned on the show, Frank, Small Time Crooks, which I think is another gem. I really, really
love
that.
I do like that one. Mm. Yeah, and Elaine May is a hoot.
Oh, she's wonderful. Well, we've gone and discussed Elaine May on this show with your suggestion of Ishtar, but I won't sort of bring that up again because it makes Tim go into convulsions.
I do like Small Time Crooks. I like Mighty Aphrodite, but it's few and far between. I didn't see Melinda and Melinda. The other one with huge, I didn't see, what's the other one with the magician?
Curse of the Jade Scorpion?
I didn't see that one.
Yeah, not terrible.
Yeah, you know, they become like almost like films made of minor short stories from his old books.
They all become crimes and misdemeanors.
Literally.
Well, that's the last great one for me.
Okay.
You know, yeah, I think I'd probably agree with that. Once he hit the 90s, it was slowly downhill and then fairly rapidly downhill as he got into the 2000s, I think.
I don't care for the musical either, the one with Julia Roberts.
Everybody Says I Love You. That was painful.
You know what is kind of amusing? It's minor, but Manhattan Murder Mystery.
I love Manhattan Murder Mystery. That's fantastic. Fun.
And I like Bullets Over Broadway.
I like that one very much.
Yeah.
The lesson to be learned here is if you only know Woody Allen from the obvious big name films, his repertoire is wide enough for you to sort of go and dig in and really just experiment with some of these films. I don't know. I mean, there are some films which, you know, as I said, were pretty bad, but even some of the minor films still have a lot that are worth recommending. And you mentioned Manhattan Murder Mystery, and that's great. I mean, even if you take from it the Lady from Shanghai tribute late in the film.
Yes.
I mean, really, a film that has Alan Alda and Angelica Houston and obviously Diane Keaton coming back. And there's just comedy magic in that film. And I never remember his name. A great character actor who was in The Sopranos, and he was in Northern Exposure. The
guy that turns out to be the killer.
That's right.
I just went to see City Lights at the New York Philharmonic, and he was sitting behind me.
Oh, get him on the podcast, Frank. You need him.
That's his name. He was on Mad About You with Paul Reiser. What the hell is his name?
Jerry Adler.
Jerry Adler.
Good,
solid workman-like New York actor. As long as you're talking about Allen films that are great and underrated, we have to mention Radio Days. I think it's underappreciated. Gil and I did an episode about it.
That's right.
That one is just about flawless, in my opinion.
Actually, I think the other thing that film has in common with Broadway Danny Rose is you come away from it saying it's sweet.
Yeah.
I mean that as high praise. I know often you can say, you know, well, sweet is a good description for something that you consider light and fluffy. But no, I just think it just has a warmth and a heart to it that two films don't have.
It's the Emmys.
All right. So look, we'll wrap up our discussion of Broadway Danny Rose and Peripheral, because this sort of was a really wonderful all-encompassing conversation. I'm so glad that we had it. Before we go into what next month's film is, Frank, thank you so much for being part of this.
Of course, gents. Always fun.
All grateful and looking forward to thinking what the next film that we can get you to come on the show will be.
Okay.
But, Tim, I think it's your pick for episode 41 next month. What'll it be?
Well, I've been keeping this one in my pocket for good long while, and I think it's about time. Roger Corman did a little film with we've been talking about New York for the last couple of hours, so next month we're going to do a film about the Brothers from Brooklyn, Rock and Roll High School.
Finally.
Good Lord.
See if you can get Alan Arkush to come on and talk about it. He's still around.
Yeah, I would love to do that.
Can you get us Alan Arkush, Frank?
I don't know the man.
Oh God. All right.
I'm sure I can put you in touch with the right people.
Looking forward immensely to talking a little Ramones, a little Riff Randall. I actually did this with Dr. Zom on Love That Album, but I think I'm definitely ripe for a revisit. And this podcast, we have to do Rock and Roll High School. So immensely looking forward to that next month.
Yeah.
So just housekeeping, if you like the show, you're listening to the show, please let people know that we exist. You can download us from seeheer.podbean.com. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/seeheerpodcast. seeheerpodcast@gmail.com is our email address. And just come up with some more suggestions. We've actually taken all our requests for this year, but You never
send us some more.
Throw us some more. You might think, oh, what a great film. So, like, you know, a couple of months ago, we discussed a fantastic film, Payday, which wasn't an official request, but, you know, sort of got snuck in by stealth by our good friend Rodrigo. So you never know. You might come up with something that we thought, why didn't we think of that? Fantastic. We're, you know, we're a friendly mob. We'll invite you to come on and join us and discuss your choice of film. That's what we're here for. Music-related films is what we try to do. In case you hadn't got our brief until now. All right, so I think on that note, we've had a great time. It's the Amos. And
let me just say to you guys that I don't just see you guys doing podcasts and joints.
You do believe, Frank.
Big things for this show. You're going to make a beautiful dollar in this business, Morris. Oh.
We got to smile. We got to be strong.
We're perennials.
Strong. Oh, why isn't
thanks for inviting me on.
Can I just say, Frank, yeah, thank you very much for coming on. I know you're a busy guy, and we really appreciate you taking time to spend some time with us.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate being asked, and we'll do it sometime down the road.
All right, so with that, try not to eat too much, otherwise you'll get a little bit of agita, and we'll see you next month on See Here in the Rock and Roll High School. Until then, cheers.
Yes.
Bye.
My lovely, lovely woman, I hate to see her cry, but when I start to manja, I get the evil eye. My woolly's getting stronger. How the hell would my go by? Then I get it from my woman. Check the box and ask your pa. Agita, my goomba in the bonzo. When I eat, he gets a treat like a conzo. He enjoys every meal, every bite that I steal. Agita, my goomba in the bonzo.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.